Good evening, everyone. Good evening. You have tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. And who are Paradigm Shifters? From my perspective, my name is Veronica Antwistle. Paradigm Shifters are people who are making a difference in the collective of our thoughts and feelings on this planet at this time of the Great Shift. And you know what amazes me is I've noticed from hearing things on the internet and from some of the people who are very close to me, that there's a sweeping wave of improvisational theater going on around the world. And talking with somebody who's a great purveyor of improvised theater is my stepdaughter, Jane Entwistle. She and I have had great conversations about what she, as someone who ran an improv troupe for 7 years, doing a show once a week in San Francisco, and also someone who has her master's degree in drama therapy, and tends to be a very perspicacious, kind of witty person who sees into the human drama and human dilemma. She's explained so much about improv to me that talked about how it is truly shifting the paradigm in many of the people that are willing to undergo it. So let's welcome to the show Jane Entwistle. We're going to pick her brains and maybe even laugh. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Thank you, Veronica. I'm very excited to be here.
So you've done improv a lot, and I knew you as a young girl.
You sure did.
Yeah, when you were like 13 and 14, you were already involved in what you called theater sports?
Well, I didn't quite start theater sports that young, but I started getting involved in drama when I was about 13, and improv is one of the fundamental techniques in teaching drama, and it was the thing that I really gravitated towards.
And why would they use improv as a fundamental technique for teaching drama?
Well, because theater is about working together as an ensemble on stage in a play, and improv are sort of the building blocks of learning how to be a good performer. All the things that make you a great stage performer, you can learn in improv.
So explain what improv is. I'm not sure what it is.
Improv is basically anything unscripted, and it doesn't just have to be drama. You find improv in jazz, when the musicians go off of scored music and just start improvising with instruments. Mm-hmm. You can improvise songs, you can improvise poems, you can improvise dance. It's basically anything that's unscripted and unplanned, spontaneous, and it doesn't have to be funny. The funny is a byproduct.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. So improvisational theater can be Pinter kind of stuff.
Oh, it can be very dramatic. In fact, there's a form of theater called, this goes more into the psychological realm of theater, called playback theater, where people tell stories from their lives that had a big impact on them, and they would like to change the story, change the impact on them. So what they do is they get with a playback group, and they kind of reinvent the story and rewrite it. They improvise the story. Now, you could say, well, the story's scripted. It already happened in history. But what they're improvising is the outcome, trying to change the emotional impact.
So when you say improvising, say it's some trauma that you've experienced, maybe when your folks split up or something like that, that you actually go back. And then what do you do with it? Write it? Rewrite it?
Well, so you tell the story to your group.
Okay.
And then you cast your story from the students in the group. You say, I'd like you to play my mother, I'd like you to play my father. I never had, maybe the concept is I never had an opportunity to say how I felt, and that's had a huge impact on me. So I'm going to rewrite the story, as it were, and I want a chance to say how I felt, how I feel. So they cast the characters, and then they go in, and they can either play themselves, or they can have someone else play themselves, so they can be an observer of their own story, and then they rewrite the ending. They improvise the ending.
So what happens, like, if you were observing yourself being played by someone else and someone's playing your mom and dad, was go back to a very simple thing, like when somebody's folks split up, right? Mm-hmm. So what happens to you? Do you feel a resonance with, like, what happens?
Well, that would be the hope, that you get some kind of a cathartic release in seeing your story told as you wish it had been, and that it would be empowering.
And have you experienced that?
I've done playback theater before, and it's very powerful. It's usually not very funny, because people do tend to go back and relive experiences that were painful where they wish they had said this, or they wish they had participated in a different way. So that's a very powerful example of how improv can be used, and it's not very funny.
Well, now, when you did your master's degree in counseling psychology, you did a drama therapy major. Is that what that's like? Is that drama therapy like that? Playback?
It can be. I specifically used improv with severely emotionally disturbed children in East Oakland. I would use improv as a way to problem solve, as a way to see alternative endings to situations.
So you would use the playback theater technique?
Not the playback technique so much as using a spontaneous form of play to determine different outcomes. If Billy punches Joey in the face and gets in trouble, that's not going to benefit anybody in the long run. Obviously, we want to get away from the hitting behavior. So how can we use improv as a way to practice different ways of handling anger? Instead of hitting, let's practice talking. Let's practice taking a breath as you're about to throw that punch. Let's practice a different emotional response.
And did the kids like that?
They love it. I mean, they don't necessarily know that they're working on these deep emotional issues. They think it's getting to do play acting and that it's play, but it resonates with them because they get to see themselves differently. It gives them a different perspective on their own reality.
So how young? Sounds like you could do that with somebody who's very young.
Oh, sure. I've done improv with three-year-olds. I'm not necessarily working on emotional things. I mean, children are doing improv all the time. They're making up stories and they're improvising being parents and being nurses and doctors. And what I think is interesting is that we come into the world as master improvisers and then slowly work our way into inhibition and fear of being spontaneous, and then we have to go to classes to learn how to be spontaneous.
So is that what an improv troupe is teaching me if I join someone?
Yeah, definitely. They're teaching you how to be spontaneous, but there's also a lot of... First of all, one of the myths of improv is that it doesn't require any practice. People say, how can you rehearse improv? It's made up. What you're rehearsing is structure. Once you have structure, then you're safe to expand as far as you want. The same concept applies to working with children. You have to supply children with a structure. You have to give them the rules. They have to know the parameters. When they know the parameters and everyone's playing by the same rules, there's a safety there. We all understand the shared environment. We all understand that we're going to play by the same rules and there's safety there. From within that environment, then you can expand in your imagination as far as you want to go. If there's no rules, everyone feels a little wild because who's going to corral? Who's going, if there's no rules, there's no safety. So improv is actually extremely structured.
Oh, wow.
And once that structure is understood by everyone, then it's limitless where you can go.
Well, what are some of the rules of the structure? One of them is the group dynamic, isn't it?
Well, there's definitely group mind, which is a really interesting concept that we can talk about that I think really applies to the paradigm shifter mentality. But one of the main structures or main rules of improv is the idea of yes and.
Oh, okay.
And yes and means...
Oh, I should have said yes and right then.
Yes and is a fundamental acceptance of that which is offered.
Okay.
So if we're on stage together... And I make an offer to you, and the offer is, let's go to the park. And you say, no, you've completely blocked my offer, and we have nowhere to go, and it's very awkward.
It's like end of discussion.
End of discussion. You've blocked me, the energy has stopped, and there's nowhere for that energy to go.
So a person might back up and be kind of angry or resentful or inward or...
Exactly.
Okay.
So the idea that whatever I offer to you is accepted with this yes and keeps the energy going and raises it higher and higher. So if I say to you, let's go to the mall, and you say, yes, and let's buy some shoes.
Okay.
And then I say, yes, and we'll put on a fashion show with the shoes. So you see, the offers are going back and forth. It's like a game of tennis, and we're volleying this energy between us, and it gets to grow and grow and rise and rise.
Yeah, visually, it kind of looks like an expanding story with...
Exactly, what it is, an expanding story. So this concept of yes and, you wouldn't believe how difficult it is for the beginning student to get.
Hmm.
And I think it's because when we're afraid, it's so much easier to say no and lock down than it is to take a chance and accept the offer and keep the energy going.
There's quite a vulnerability required to just keep things going, isn't there?
Huge vulnerability. And also, what the beginning student wants to do is place all of the onus and responsibility on you. So by not making an offer back, not accepting, and making you be responsible mm-hmm. for where the scene goes, they think that it's an easier place to be. It's an easier place to make you responsible and not to take any responsibility. Mm. But you know what? It makes it difficult for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this concept is something that can be carried through to all walks of life. It doesn't have to just stay in the improv arena.
I know. I was looking at this, some of this on the internet, and it said the history of urban improv, and it said it was created as a response to Boston's escalating youth violence.
Well, yeah, because that's just a whole bunch of people going, no, 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 locking down and becoming resistant and defiant.
And defiant.
And if you have resistance and defiance on stage, you have a very limited arena in which to play. So I can totally see that being applied to an urban situation. They use it a lot in corporate training.
What about Congress?
Well, imagine if Congress said yes and all the time.
Yeah, really.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. Can you imagine what an evolutionary... I would jump to the conclusion that it would be very evolutionary.
It would be absolutely evolutionary. And it doesn't mean that every offer is great.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the concept that I'm willing to go with you. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to support you. And even if the idea, the offer you made me was a silly one, or not a very imaginative one, I'm still going to be there with you as your partner on stage, and I'm still going to yes and you no matter what, even if it means that I have to dance in circles and get my mind thinking really hard how to make your offer work. Because what, you know, if you said, let's go turn ourselves inside out. Okay, well, that's going to be hard to do. Mm-hmm. It's going to be hard to act. I'm a good actress, but I have some limits. So I have to work really hard on how I can make this work. But I'm not going to sit there and go, that's dumb. Or, you know what, we really can't turn ourselves inside out. I'm going to work twice as hard to make you look good, too. That's one of the other rules in improv, is that we're a partnership. We're a team. And my role is to help you look and feel as good as possible,
mm-hmm.
because in turn that will make me look and feel as good as possible, and now the audience is going to feel good.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could take some of these concepts out into the world instead of blocking each other and being resistant all the time, mostly it's just a willingness to listen. Another important rule of improv.
It's really interesting because while you're talking, I'm thinking of, for example, subjects like the healthcare system. You know, if people were into the yes and, the malleability of that really, really terrifying, polarized subject would be much more interesting, wouldn't it? Everybody would have a way to kind of shape the common need.
Yes. And I think what it would do would be to flesh out more and more ideas because people would feel heard. So much people don't feel heard. We're terrible communicators,
mm-hmm.
as an en masse, I believe.
Well, it seemed that communicating—if you were allowed to communicate—then other people get defensive. That's sort of the way our society is run, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's a myth, really.
Yeah,
I think.
Yes, I agree.
Because all it requires is that we truly listen, and by listening fully, letting people finish their sentences, not pre-plan. See, here's the thing with improv. You can't pre-plan in your head what you're going to say. Because if you do that, what you realize is you're not actually hearing, fully hearing and being present with what your partner is saying.
Right to the end of the thought.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's so many concepts that apply to effective communication. This idea of listening, that you have to truly listen, you have to be present, and you have to not be so concerned with your response, but rather to trust that the response will come because you are this amazing being of spontaneous reaction. So when you're on stage, you have to yes and, support your partner, really listen, not be pre-planning your thoughts.
Are they usually in partnership or can it be a whole team?
Oh, it can be a whole team. I do improv with up to 12 people on stage, which requires an inordinate amount of listening because everybody wants to put their two cents in. But what you realize then, working with a big group like that, which is also an interesting concept for life, is that what I have to say right now, is it going to further the scene? Is it going to yes and what was said? Is it going to link up with what was just said?
Mm-hmm.
Or am I just saying what I want to say to get a laugh?
It's a kind of a grandstanding thing.
A grandstanding. So then you find, what I find is that things become more poignant. Our ability to listen to each other becomes really grounded. And this sort of, you know, people think that actors are really egotistical, but you have to really get rid of that when you're working with a big ensemble like that. Because it doesn't become about the I, it becomes about the we, the group mind all working together to present something that's really elevated.
It's like a team sport, only it's of a higher nature.
Yeah.
So you did this improv troupe every week for 7 years. What happened to the people in the troupe? Did they become more awakened or evolved or more self-integrated, or what would you say?
Well, I'd like to think so, simply because we were working together as this group for so long. You definitely become like family and definitely learn each other's vulnerabilities. But
don't you learn your own, Jane? And I just interrupted you.
Oh, that's quite all right. I know how fast your mind works. And it's fun to parlay with you. I learned a lot about myself leading that group. And I was really thankful for the fact that I was studying psychology at the time. Because being at the helm of a group, especially one that required such vulnerability all the time, took a lot of human insight. And
like what? Into yourself and into them?
Into myself and into them, and into understanding that when you're requiring people to be really vulnerable, which improv requires you to be, things come up. Emotions get triggered. People's sensitivities are on display all the time. We're standing in front of 100 people. Sometimes they love us. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes we trigger the audience. We didn't mean to. And
wow, that's pretty complicated, isn't it?
Well, yeah. But I think that we're asking the audience to go on a vulnerable ride, too, because as much as they have to trust us, we have to trust the audience. It's kind of an interesting relationship. I don't think people necessarily think of trusting the audience. But basically, the unwritten agreement is, we're going to stand up here and be vulnerable for about an hour. We have no idea what we're going to say or do, and we need your full support. And what is so fascinating to me is that some of the best improv I've seen in L.A., I live in Los Angeles, people's response, audience's response, has been one of anger because they feel that they don't say this is so good it can't be improv. They just flat out refuse to believe that it is improv. And they get angry about it.
Why do they get angry?
I have no idea. I've not figured that out.
Because they feel duped?
They feel duped, but they haven't been duped. It truly is improv.
So it's an expectation that theater is a certain kind of thing.
But even that doesn't, I mean, the expectation we set up is we're going to improvise for you and we hope you really like it. And then they come and then they're angry because they say this can't possibly be improv. I don't understand that response at all.
Yeah, but you know what's funny about that is I'm thinking that people's subconscious programming, which is what we're always working on in this show and with the various people that we talk to, our subconscious programming tyrannizes our lives at times, you know. So I'm thinking that people in the audience, no matter what you say consciously, they're being triggered because inside they've got an expectation of how it's supposed to be some other way, right? So they're not letting go.
I think that's true. And
so you talked about vulnerability. That's not being vulnerable. It's hard for people.
Huh? No, that's actually doing the opposite of yes and.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't that fascinating?
It is fascinating. Going back to yes and, I know there's so many interesting things to talk about. When students start mastering the yes and, the next step they tend to fall into is the yes but.
Oh.
So they think they've got the yes and covered, and then they start sliding into this yes but, which is still a negative.
Mm-hmm.
It's yes, but why don't we do this, which essentially is still a negative.
Yeah, we used to joke about that. As soon as somebody says yes but, you know they're disagreeing with you, but they're trying to be polite.
It's so funny how our psyche just wants to get around that concept of yes and. I don't know why it's so difficult for us as people.
Because we hold our own with resistance, I think.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It's sort of interesting.
And we're not really used to work. Even I think, I know going, the reason why improv is so popular with corporate trainings is because you have a group of people seemingly working together, and yet the groups seem to constantly break down, and I think it's because you have a lot of individuals working side by side, but not necessarily working together, cultivating this idea of group mind.
So we weren't playing. Yes, we weren't taught to play for the good of the group, were we?
No.
Well, so tell me, is there somebody? I believe that you mentioned a couple of years ago somebody who was doing some really big. I don't know if it's political work or social consciousness work using improv. A woman, maybe in New York?
Well, there's a lot of work going on with improv and social consciousness, but I'm wondering if you're talking about Charna Halpern, who
yes.
went to CERN
mm-hmm.
in Geneva.
That's the name.
To work with the physicists.
Yes.
I find this absolutely fascinating and quite hilarious. A few years back, 2 years back, 2008 or so, when the physicists in Geneva were getting ready to unveil their big Hadron Collider, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They hired a physicist there named Bob Stanek, hired Charna Halpern, who's founded a group in Chicago and L.A. called Improv Olympic, which has been going for many, many, many years. She's very famous. To come out and work with the physicists so that, because there was so much public fear of this collider, that they were going to create a black hole that was going to end all life as we knew it,
mm-hmm.
that they wanted the physicists to be prepared to field questions, concerns, emotional outcries, but knowing the way their physicists were, they thought they might be in a little bit of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So they hired Charna to come in and do improv.
And what's her name? Charna?
Charna Halpern.
Okay.
And they hired, and she worked with about 25 physicists there.
Wow.
And to basically teach them these basic concepts of improv so that they could be more, not only more spontaneous with the public and at the ready to respond, but also how to work together more spontaneously.
So to break down the ego, would you say?
Yeah, I guess it, I don't know if it's, I guess it's to break down the ego, but it's more to sort of instill this, even just the concept of yes and, of listening to one another, of allowing people's ideas to be heard and yes anded so that they felt more secure in offering their ideas and their creative collaborations. And they're working on
big news, yes.
Yeah, big news, big, powerful things. So you can see how cultivating a group mind in that situation could be so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And the physicists spoke of it. You know, they said that improv was undeniably harder than physics, which I think is fascinating. They said improvisers are working in the millisecond. I thought physicists were working that fast too, but And
did it work for them to be more cohesive or more organic?
They all immediately signed up to be in an improv group that was going to perform seriously at a huge convention.
Wow!
A month later.
Wow!
For thousands of people.
Wow! Isn't that great?
And they could at the start of the workshop, they were nervous. They were giggly. They were asked to do funny little warm-up things, like, here's something that I do in my class, too. And it's, for me, it's working on this concept of group mind, which I find so fascinating, is that you ask them, students, to mill around the room, and then without speaking, they're to form a letter, a single letter, with their bodies, one letter. They're all to form one letter, not individually form a letter, but come together. You know when you see the blimps over the football field and all the bodies have either made a picture or spelt a word?
Right.
It's the same concept.
Well, but just one letter.
One letter. It sounds easy.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you convey to your fellow man that, gee, it looks like we're all creating an O? But you can't point. You can't direct.
Oh, you can't.
Wiggle your eyes and get someone to stand over here. There's to be no director. And it's just this coming together and kind of an agreement. And it's really funny, but you know what? It can be done. And when it's done, you would not believe the look of surprise.
It's really intuitive then.
It's a completely intuitive process, but it's this unspoken agreement.
Hmm.
And there's a lot of hemming and hawing, and it can get frustrating, especially when everyone thinks we're doing an L, and then one person in the group clearly thinks it's another letter and breaks off, and then it all goes to... And then they got to start again. But that's what Charna Halpern did with the physicists. That was the first exercise they did. And then from there, they went on to playing Yes and playing all kinds of different games. And they said that it was really helpful. And one of the biggest issues they had was feeling shut down all the time creatively. Well, for their physics ideas. But feeling shut down, that there was no room for them to talk. So in improv,
so wait a minute.
You can't
when
do that.
When you're doing physics and you've got this great, what is it called, the hadron?
The hadron, I don't know if I'm saying it right, the hadron collider.
Yeah, the collider. I guess it, like any other major project with really high-end producers, there isn't much chit-chat. There isn't much expression. Everybody's sort of sticking to the task at hand, aren't they?
Well, I think at the end result, but at the beginning, the brainstorming process, you know, and this thing is, was 14 years in the making. So if you go back 14 years, when imagine them sitting around going, I wonder if we can create. And then if somebody goes, no, then where do you go from there?
Right.
But
or somebody's,
if somebody goes,
or somebody's really introverted or somebody's really scared to put his ideas forward.
And it's so easy to feel shot down.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't mean that, yes, we have to go with every crazy idea that ever was, but we at least have to let it live in the world for a minute and see where it could go. Yes, and we can turn ourselves inside out and show our amazing colors on that we have on the inside on the outside. Yes, and people will want to turn themselves inside out too, and pretty soon, who knows where that skit could go.
I always get really excited about the innate, the essential power of each human being, but it has to come out, doesn't it? So you're saying that this actually helps release people into who they are, into how
it helps release people. There, improv requires an acute sense of observation, observing yourself, observing your own reactions in the world, observing the people that you're on stage with, observing every single reaction that they've said, clocking. My teacher in Los Angeles' name is Patrick Bristow. He's a very accomplished improviser, a famous TV and film performer. And one of the analogies he uses is that it's like a periscope. Improv is getting your periscope up and observing the world at large all the time while being in the moment. And I love this idea.
Sounds really metaphysical, doesn't it?
Well, I think it is really metaphysical. It's kind of, I guess it's a little bit like having your third eye open. Instead of looking down at the ground as you walk and only seeing the space in front of you, You can do that, but if you have your periscope up, you're taking in the world at large. And I think that we don't do that. We're very insular and isolated. If we could all get our little periscopes up while we're walking down the street, we might notice that somebody needs help carrying their groceries. You know, we expand out of ourselves and see that there's a lot going on that we're clocking all the time. But we don't pay attention to that. So improv requires us to have the periscope up, to be listening acutely all the time, to be making eye contact with our fellow players on stage, which is really important, and that creates an emotional connection. We tend to not look at one another, and then we don't have to emotionally connect.
Yeah, we're afraid of its intimacy.
Yeah, improv is very intimate. And the amount of trust in ourselves and in our fellow players is one of the biggest things, and it's the hardest thing to teach. When I'm teaching, one of the things that I require my students to do is to, because what I say is, it's not enough to come to class for 1 hour a week and expect yourself to be on stage, be open, take chances and risks that you would never take in your everyday life, sound different, do funny voices, walk differently. It's incredibly vulnerable. 1 hour a week is not enough. So practice. Practice in your life. When you're sitting in your car, observe your world. Pay attention. Step out of your own insular reality and start reading billboards. Start observing all of the people on the street. See how they walk. See how they react. It's this observation that is so amazing and enriching that I think people could do it, and they don't have to be improvisers.
Well, I'm going to jump into something more personal for you, which is I've seen you perform as Miss Marple in Agatha Christie doing improv. Oh, my gosh. And there were like 12 other people, and they're all kinds of murderers and so on. And you're supposed to find the culprit, right, when there's been a mystery. And you're talking about paying attention. You must find it. How long did it take you to get to the point where you could actually pay attention to that much detail with that many people in order to solve the mystery? And you always solve it, don't you?
Well, I do. Ironically, it's improv, so I'm making it up as I go.
But it's pretty saleable. I could really be impressed by what appears to be.
I think it is. It's by far the most challenging improv I've ever done. An hour show, 12 characters on stage. It's an improvised Agatha Christie. Everybody gives a motive for the murder, and everyone gives an alibi for the murder. And at the end, I have to solve the crime by relating to all the motives and alibis given. And what's funny is I never consider that I have a particularly good memory. But my character, whose name is actually Dorothea Stack, I always joke that she has a far better memory than I. Part of that, I think, is the permission I give her to have that memory, which is something I haven't quite put my finger on yet, why I wouldn't allow myself to have that same kind of memory.
Is that your intuition that you're infusing with the power?
I think probably it's intuition. But it's a lot of trust. Because here's the irony. It's a lot of details to keep track of and a lot of information. And if I think about the details and the information, I will be completely lost. You cannot think in improv. It is the kiss of death. As soon as you engage the analytical part of your mind, it's like this channel to something higher shuts down completely. The fear steps in, the restriction steps in, that openness closes down, and what happens is panic. When panic happens, there's no expansion. And it's absolutely terrifying. And that's where most beginning improvisers find themselves all the time, because they're trying to engage their analytical mind.
Have you ever really messed up on stage in the middle of an improv? Have you ever frozen yourself up?
Well, what I've done is, in the Agatha Christie that we're talking about, I've been off stage, and I have to be listening to what's going on stage, because there could be valuable information there. But I start thinking too hard, and I can feel it closing in, the walls of fear and terror start closing in, because I'm starting to think, and I have to stop and go, and literally shut off my mind. So then I wonder, what part of me then can remember all of those details and facts without actually thinking on the details and facts? And it's trust. It's this trust that it will happen. It's a really interesting relationship with myself that
that's very interesting.
That I really enjoy, but is hard to get to. And that's not an egotistical thing, like, oh, I've gotten far with trusting myself. It's not like that. But it's a really, it's something out of body. I don't even really know how to explain it. It's where you stop thinking, and yet some part of your mind is thinking somewhere, putting it all together. And then I trust that when I open my mouth, it'll come out in this beautiful little package. Sometimes it's more beautiful than others. But it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
It always has. It never has not. So it's encouraging students that if they keep going, keep practicing, they will get to that point of trust where they can open their mouth and something will come out. It always does.
Is it channeling, Jane?
I think it is.
Yeah, really?
I really do.
How long do you think people study? How long did you have to practice before you could be sure? Or before you could trust yourself?
I had to practice a lot, and I studied theater for a lot of years. And like I said, improv is always at the basis of theater training. But I also think it's something that I was kind of set up to do. I think it flows through me easily. I'm a Pisces. I'm really easy at going with the flow of changing, changing direction. And I think that really helps me not be so rigid.
Mm-hmm.
I find that people who have more rigid personalities tend to have to work a little harder at allowing the flow to come through.
It seems to me that somebody talking about rigidity, somebody who has, let's pick arthritis, that has all kinds of anger stuffed into joints and so on in the body, it would seem that it might be a great way to help even in physical healing.
I think so, because if we start delving into the psychology and emotion inherent in performance, I think there's a whole wealth of learning there.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. Stanislavski, one of our great theatrical
gurus
and grandfathers, when he first started his theatrical practice, he would have everyone go into something that everybody knows about, which is the emotional recall. He would require actors to go into their own emotional histories and lives to fuel their characters. And what he wound up with was a lot of hysterical actors. Because he was asking actors to go into their emotional past and relive it all the time. Well, so that says something really powerful about the art of performance.
He had them drop into and actually be what it was he wanted them to.
Well, do a memory.
Mm-hmm.
He would have them go a memory recall. And then he started seeing how taxing it was. It provided for some good theater, but it was very taxing. So he changed his mode and he kind of flipped it around and started having people go more into a physical manifestation to get to an emotional place.
So they would do a posture?
That's one of the ways that I really love to get at character, is to shift up the body. You know, if you curl your, I was reading about this earlier, but if you curl your lip and crinkle your eyebrow and start to growl as if you're being angry, pretty soon you'll start to feel angry. And then if you stay with that
I'm doing it right now, and I'm starting to build it up inside.
You can feel it.
Yes, you can.
Because your body has an amazing connection between physical experiences and emotional experiences. It's fast. We have millions at our fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great way to get to character, but it's also a great way to get at emotion, to get at locked in feelings and pains. It's one of the reasons why I really wanted to go into drama therapy. Because the body is this amazing theatrical storehouse of memories and emotions. and the way that we're physically constructed, the way that we physically construct ourselves over the years can represent the kind of emotions that we have buried in there.
Yeah, you can tell by the way people walk down the street what their mental and emotional state is. I know that. That's really interesting, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And so for the students who are not so self-aware, I'll say, observe people. Observe that. What do you think's going on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you see someone whose chest is really concave, you know, this kind of sunken concave chest, you know, try taking that on. Try moving around like that person, and what kind of feelings does that bring up?
Hmm. Are you doing any drama therapy right now?
I'm not doing any drama therapy, but the classes that I'm teaching down in Los Angeles have a lot of sort of sensitive emotional work built into getting at character and getting at these basic tenets of improv. One of the things I mentioned earlier was this concept of group mind, which not a lot of improvisers talk about group mind, but they talk about it in more of a sort of jokey way. Improv is still a little bit of a guy's thing. I don't know why improv is full of...
You mean boy people?
Yeah, boy people. It's full of quirky women, but it's still kind of dominated by men. I don't understand why that is, because I think women can be extremely funny.
Mm-hmm.
So in any case, you don't hear a lot of people talking about the more emotional sides of improv. But there I am in my classes talking about it all the time. And the thing that I'm fascinated with group mind is this concept of nonverbal communication
mm-hmm.
between a group of people or between two people. And I think that it's very powerful. And I think that it can do... I mean, it's no different than the... meditators getting together on the steps of
Washington, yeah, the Pentagon.
That's group mind.
Yes.
At work.
And it creates a field, right? And in that field is terrific information.
Yeah. So one of the exercises we do is everyone closes their eyes, they stand on stage, they get a little personal space around them, they close their eyes, and then they all jump at the same time.
Oh, really? And what happens?
It's fascinating to watch. And then you have to break up the... Because you can get into kind of a rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
1, 2, 3, jump. 1, 2, 3, jump. And if everybody starts agreeing nonverbally on that time, then after a while, everybody catches on that we're doing 1, 2, 3, jump. You know, so you got to kind of break that up.
Isn't that what advertising does to us?
Exactly. Boy. But it's so amazing to sit and watch 25 people on stage jumping at the same time mm-hmm. and then to see their faces just light up. Did we just do that?
Wow.
How did we do that? Another one I do is I have everyone, and this is very common in improv, you have everyone turn, you stand in a circle, turn their back to the circle, and you have to count. No order, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And if two people say the same number at the same time, you have to go back to 1. So the goal is how high can you get?
So it could be 1 and then across the circle is 2. And
exactly. Yeah. But there's no rhyme or reason. There's no order. And it's seeing how high you can get. And after every few couple of numbers, I'll say take a deep breath. Get really grounded. Try to feel when it's your turn to say the number, which a lot of them will laugh and balk at.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean, try and feel it? Well, you can feel it. Get really calm and really centered, and you just know, it's my turn to say 11. And sometimes you can feel the energy coming at your back.
Hmm.
It's just really interesting. I do. Well, I'm really sensitive. So we do it, and we do it, and we do it, and then, okay, how was that? I felt when it was my turn to say a number. And then you'll hear somebody else, I didn't feel it. What does that mean? Well, you just have to work at it, you know. But when you see...
Isn't that great? I love that idea.
So this is group mind that we're
building.
Yeah,
that's great.
Because then when you go to do something complicated like Agatha Christie on stage with 12 people, and you have this group mind just buzzing, then there isn't a lot of over-talking.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a lot of interrupting. Well, what if we could take this concept and bring this into the world? This concept of yes and, this mm-hmm. concept of group mind, this concept of true effective communication.
Mm-hmm.
These are not foreign concepts. They're not uberly brilliant to improv.
But what's really interesting is I'm always working with my understanding of the collective and how to paradigm shifters that make a difference in the collective. What if the collective was a more conscious group mind where people actually made the effort to be in a group mind? Our world would be just a stunning place, wouldn't it?
It would be, and it is not impossible to accomplish if we took...
Well, it is like that now, but it's an unconscious approach, right?
Yes, and there's not... I wouldn't say there's a ton of people who really believe in the emotional, spiritual concepts of improv when they're doing the goofy kind of ha-ha improv. But I do. I see its potential. I know other people do too. And there are people working with it at that level. But what if we could take these concepts into schools? What if we could teach children, yes and, so that every child in math and science and English feels that they can give their ideas, that they're not going to be shut down, that people are going to truly listen and make eye contact with them, and that they do have a sense of group mind in the classroom, so they can all function as this really integrated, beautiful unit.
And one of the stories I was reading online was about a woman who teaches history at a university, and she finally went into improv to find ways to evoke in the students the ability to keep really big discussions alive.
Oh, yeah.
On many historical subjects. I thought that was precious.
Yeah. Well, and going back to the concept of playback theater, what if we took historical, and I'm sure there's teachers doing this, but historical situations that didn't turn out so well, and have the students improvise in a playback kind of format, a different outcome, and then to hypothesize about how would the world have been different. That's an interesting way to use improv.
Well, that sounds very exciting because so often we're taught that we can create our reality by creating the emotional content of outcomes, right?
Mm-hmm.
The visual and emotional. I'm going, oh, well, that's all in alignment with that, isn't it?
It completely is in alignment. And I...
Well, Jane, is it going on all over the world? Are they doing it in China? Are they doing it in Russia? Are they doing it in Africa?
Well, I know they're definitely doing it in Russia. Russia is a huge proponent of theater and the cutting edge of theater. And the thing that I love about Russia is that they have a very, very high regard for the arts, for theater and performance. And it's almost on par with a government job.
Unless where Stanislavski came from, right?
I can't remember where. Did he come from Russia?
Well, that's a Russian name.
Yes. And I love that. I wish we had that here. But instead, what do you hear is the first thing that's going to get cut from our school funding, the arts, which is too bad.
But if a lot of teachers of all kinds took improv and got their kids to do that, it wouldn't matter if it was mathematics or... You know, they could apply it all through all classes, couldn't they?
There isn't a single topic you couldn't apply improv to. There isn't a single... We're improvising this conversation. Mm-hmm. We haven't scripted it. That's the thing.
We thought about it.
Well, we thought about it, but, you know, what did we do? We created a structure.
Right.
Right? You'll ask me some questions about this and this. Well, we have a shared understanding of the realm in which we're talking, and from there, who knows where we'll go, but we both feel safe. Mm-hmm. In that we understand the rules. There's nothing wrong with that. I am a huge proponent of the rules because there is nothing scarier than being on stage with someone who is not following the rules.
Have you had that experience?
Oh, yes.
And what do you do with that person?
Well, if you're a good improviser, you yes and them anyways, even though they're denying and there's nothing more awkward than saying, Professor, I need to borrow your pen. I'm not a professor, and this isn't a pen. Okay, here we go.
Dead end.
Right? How many people do you know that are like that in real life?
Lots.
Right? And how frustrating is it? And you have to work so hard. And it...
Yeah, there's a lot of people like that.
Yeah. And it's fear.
Mm-hmm. It's caging. We don't realize how caged we are at times by our own reactions, right?
Yeah, but what is so... What is so hard to get across to my students, and it's the simplest concept, is that, first of all, When you're up on stage, I can see you, whether you give 10% or 100%. So it's like the child who hides in the clothing rack at the store, and you can see them from the waist down, but they think you can't see them at all. I can see you on stage, and I want you to succeed. Everything in my heart wants you to soar and succeed. So first of all, you have my full support. Second of all, if you're up there and you can be seen, why give 10%? Why not go full throttle and give 100%? Because we see you give 10% and we're disappointed by it. Because we want you to succeed. It's the hardest thing to get across. The second of all, that to shut down and to block and deny makes me safe. But in actuality, it doesn't. Because you have nowhere to go. You're stuck. That's not a safe place to be.
That's the life of quiet desperation.
Yeah, but if I yes and, and I go with you and I trust you, then suddenly we're both hand in hand, rising up. And it's a much safer place to be. But it's so funny, people think that it's safer to live in the fear. And it really isn't, not on stage, and I don't think in life either.
Because they don't want to experience vulnerability, probably, hey?
No, but I don't think there's anything more vulnerable than being on stage, being seen, and blocking and denying is an incredibly vulnerable place to be. I would rather go 100% and go with you and trust you. I think that's I'd much rather be there anytime.
So we're going to near the end of this. Well, we are nearing the end of our discussion, which is too bad. But I want to know what you're going to do besides going to, for example, the Democratic Convention and leaving one of these. Are you going to lead one of these then?
I would love to. I would love to take improv to Congress.
Wouldn't that be great?
I think that if I could get all of those people playing yes and, that would be a huge victory, not only for improv, but for all people everywhere.
Well, you know, it's funny because in the last election, I kept saying we need to have a team for president, not one person, because in essence, there is a team of deniers or. But there's not an actual team, a group mind that's officially in that role. So no. I think that you should run for president, take your team with you.
Okay, I'll do it. I'll do it.
And what are you really doing, yes and?
Yes.
What
yes.
are you doing?
When am I doing yes and?
Anything that you're doing in the next little while that you can tell people about, we'd love to hear about.
Well, I'm actually, if you're down in the Los Angeles area, on January 8th, my group Improvatorium, led by the infamous Patrick Bristow, we will be performing our zombie holiday show.
Yay!
Even though it's after the holidays, there's still a high demand for it. And that's on January 8th.
What's a zombie holiday show? What is that?
Well, it's the Wallace family who's doing their Christmas special that they do every year. But this year they've decided to include their undead relatives because it is the season of acceptance. And the kind of chaos that ensues with trying to get zombies to make holiday cookies and wrap presents. It's very funny. And then we will be doing...
Well, and the zombies are supposed to be coming out full force by 2012.
Oh, well, yes. I just
so
hope they're really good improvisers.
Yes, and.
Yes, and then and then we'll be doing our improvised Rome, which is an epic Roman improvised hilarious farce. So.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Yes,
eh?
I'm excited about that.
And what are your personal goals? What else? Oh, and give your website. How can people learn more about you and you're making huge strides into your own self-realization, your performance, wanting to be in movies and so on? How can we keep in touch with what you do?
Well, I have a fun little website called The Jane Show, and that's Jane with a Y, J-A-Y-N-E. And all of my goings-on are there. And I will be on an episode of Big Love this year.
Yay! When's that coming out?
Well, I don't know the exact date, but it's episode 8, and it should premiere around March, I'm guessing. So that's been a huge, huge, wonderful success for me.
Oh, that's very exciting.
This last year, yeah, I'm very excited about that.
Now, I know this isn't news, but you have some wonderful YouTubes where you play, you improvise.
I improvise the Russian nanny. Yes, and if you go to YouTube and look up Nanny Angry Potato, because Nanny has some great advice about being angry, then you will see all of Nanny's videos.
Yeah, it's so fun, everybody. I really recommend that you take a look at it. So our guest tonight, I don't even like to let you go, but our guest tonight has been Jane Entwistle, and I'm really happy to report she's my stepdaughter. We get to spend a lot of time together, and we learn a lot of things together. And I'm going to have to do some improv.
Yes,
I can see that.
Yes. Yes, yeah. And
study. Yes, and study with Jane Entwistle. This is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for tuning into Paradigm Shifters. Yes, and you too are a paradigm shifter. Let's make changes on our planet. If you'd like to be in touch with me, give us feedback on this show. It's Veronica@VeronicaEntwistle.com. No H in Entwistle. Veronica@VeronicaEntwistle.com. Or you can be in touch with Jane at Jane Entwistle. No, wait a second.
The Jane Show. Yes.
All right. The Jane Show with a Y in Jane. And thank you very much for listening. Many, many blessings. Good night.